From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Pete Hamill is my guest. He's a journalist and a novelist and the author of many books. His latest is a wonderful book of short pieces called The Christmas Kid and Other Brooklyn Stories. Pete Hamill, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me.
The Christmas Kid and Other Brooklyn Stories, it's a lovely book. What made you decide to rescue these stories right now?
The usual combination of things. I had a whole slew of old stories, more than 100 of them, and I was having problems with the novel that I was writing. So I said, maybe I could just assemble the Brooklyn ones, since Brooklyn is now hot somehow, so hot I can't afford to live there.
Brooklyn's the new Manhattan, they say.
Yeah, exactly. So and I started to read them again and said, gee, this is, you know, it's like a lost world. It's the world before the Internet, the world before a whole lot of stuff. And I thought they'd be interesting that way for some of the younger people in Brooklyn to know what was there before they were. What's the palimpsest, as the academics would say. And I began to assemble them in a certain way, and I went through and cleaned up some of the writing, you know, repeated words or something. I would go through and fine-tune them a little bit.
Do you think you're a better writer now than you were in 30 years ago?
Oh, I hope so. But I wasn't sitting there looking at it saying, gee, I could never try that today. Because inevitably if you continue to do it, you're learning something new all the way through about the craft itself, about yourself, about your friends. You begin to see the rest of the story from some of the people that you grew up with. So in that sense, it was getting back in touch with people I hadn't seen for years, or finding out that there was no way to get in touch with them. They were dead. So that's why at the beginning of the book, I dedicate the book to about 200 people, every name I could remember from that neighborhood in Brooklyn. And a few of them ended up still alive, which was, you know, embracing, to say at least, because they've been shooting at my regiment for a while now. Particularly the newspaper guys, you know.
Yes. Now, you know, when you talk about the changes in technology and so forth, I mean, how many people read a newspaper from a newspaper? You know, I mean, this is the way things have changed so much.
Yes.
I guess the whole 20th century is that acceleration of technology, but even more so in the last 15 years. Yeah.
But in a way, I think the technology can help the various mediums, including fiction. You know, if you think that of all the great writers, far greater than I am, who wrote for newspapers, Dickens, Hemingway, Damon Runyon, all kinds of people did that in other countries, Alberto Moravia, and in Italy, and Kafu Nagai in Japan. And, you know, there was a tradition of writing short fiction for newspapers. And we've lost it somewhere. You know, we think somehow that's not part of the deal, when particularly in the popular papers where all the space is taken up by bikini babes in January, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Freezing half the female audience out of the room. What I would hope would be that we, particularly for short stories, since there's so few outlets that carry short stories anymore, which is one of the great, great media in fiction. The only place you can get published, basically, is in academic small literary magazines or The New Yorker.
Yeah.
There's nowhere else, and there's no reason why the Internet might provide a home for more of those kind of stories and allow people to get an audience.
Do you ever personally read things on the Internet?
I mean, I do. I look at certain papers all the time.
And yeah.
I look at the Irish Times and the Wall Street Journal. And, mainly because I can't get those papers easily where I live.
Yeah. Well, you live in New York, don't you?
Yeah, I live in Tribeca.
Can't you get anything in New York for,
Well, you know, a good example is right around the corner there's a newsstand that sells cigarettes and, you know, the usual stuff, potato chips. but it does not have newspapers on Saturday and Sunday. You can't get Sunday Daily News. You can't get a Sunday Times. We get the Times delivered, but... do I prefer paper? Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Am I used to the other, particularly when I'm traveling? Yes.
Yeah.
Earlier this year, I spent 7 weeks in Sicily researching a new novel and writing it. And it was almost impossible to find a newspaper there for whatever reason. In 2 years... the newspapers that I used to get there, the local papers where I could sort of figure out from the noun and the verb what the story's about, gone. You know, I don't know if they're out of business or the stands don't carry them anymore. I just don't know, but I couldn't find them. So I go online and take a look.
Yeah. Well,
and if you're looking for something like basketball coverage or something, you definitely have to do it when you're traveling.
Well, you know, if you live in New York, then that spoils you for a lot of stuff. I mean, for instance, you can't get anything to eat. You can't get anything. And, you know, only in New York can you, if it's 11 o'clock at night, you want to go get eggs or a pizza. So,
<That's true. laughs>
and, you know, I grew up and spent most of my life in California, but like the song says, I happen to like New York. And you've lived in so many of the great cities of the world, but New York is your thing. What is it about New York for you?
I think it's both a combination of the familiar and the surprising. That I know where everything is. The Bronx is up and the Battery's down, you know?
Yeah.
I know the grid. I know where I am when I'm here. But on the other hand, I know that the rapidity of change in a city like New York, since it's still a dynamic city, it's not a museum, is what holds the surprises for you. When I was 30 years ago, there were not that many good Japanese restaurants. Now there's many of them. 30 years ago... you could buy a typewriter ribbon anywhere. Now it's
You could get your
like
film
a
developed.
Treasured thing for anybody that still has. I
still do. You still use it? You still use your typewriter?
I don't know. No. I have one in case there's the immense power failure of all time. I still have one with a reasonably fresh ribbon, but I don't know if I had a right. More than 40 pages, what the hell they would look like. Might be dried out into cinder blocks or something. But also because it's an immigrant town. And because of the rapidity of change. Nostalgia is one of the most powerful emotions in a city like New York. People think of it as a heartless, big, faceless kind of city, and it's not. The immigrants who came from other places to settle in New York are still carrying around the places, the fields where they ran barefoot in the summertime. And they'll carry those to their grave, whether they were in Sicily or in China or wherever the hell they are. The constant shifting, you go away for the summer, when you come back, your favorite coffee shop is gone, and Donald Trump is shoving something in the ground there where it used to be, you know?
Yeah.
Or in the monster examples, we lose two baseball teams and two football teams. We don't even have an NFL team in football.
Penn Station is gone. Did you hear about that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Nostalgia isn't what it used to be, I hear.
Yeah. That's who wrote that? Simone Signore?
I think so. That was the title of her book.
Yeah. But that understanding that, you can decode some of the things that are going on around you. There's certain Chinese musicians that show up at Canal Street and Subway Station, and they play music that has an ache in it. And you know what the ache is for? It's for the place left behind. It's just like the Irish 100 years ago singing about emigration from Ireland and knowing they would never go back. So seeing that, there's a kind of commonality to a lot of the people that live here. That's what I find rich and endlessly fascinating.
I guess that's why Jolson was a success in New York, because the songs he sang, even though they weren't his personal nostalgia, were someone's nostalgia for Mammy and back home.
Oh, yeah. Well, the one I liked by him was The Spaniard That Blighted My Life. all about how he went out for some nuts in a program at a bullfight, and the bullfighter stole his girlfriend away, you know. One of the lines is, "I'll raise a bunion on his Spanish onion, the Spaniard that blighted my life." But a lot of these guys, although they had the achy kind of sentimental songs, they also had comedy.
Yep.
They knew that the best way to handle adversity in a place like New York was to laugh at it. And the unforgivable sin was self-pity. You don't ever feel sorry for yourself. And that's true with today's immigrants, the way it was true 100 years ago with the Italians, the Irish, and the Jews. And I hope that's the way it'll go. We'll have some people from Mars here yet.
They're probably already there.
Yeah, as long as they don't go to the Bronx to work.
We're talking with Pete Hamill. You know, one of my favorite books of yours is a slim little volume called Why Sinatra Matters. And
right.
You not only have an appreciation for Sinatra, but you actually knew the guy.
I did know him, yeah.
What kind of a person was he?
First of all, you know, in spite of the Rat Pack image and all that stuff, he was very smart, and he was a reader. Just one example. He was an insomniac. He couldn't sleep at night very easily. The habits of a lifetime, you know, working in saloons at 2 o'clock in the morning instead
of. Yeah.
And so he would read. He was the guy that came up with the idea of taking Nelson Algren's Man with the Golden Arm and making a movie out of it. It wasn't a movie producer. It was Frank. And he was able to get enough people interested that they made a terrific movie out of it. So he would call. He knew that I would work nights a lot, and his other great friend here was Jimmy Cannon, the sports writer, who also was an insomniac. So it was like a network where if he was in town, if he, being Sinatra, was in town, don't be surprised if you get a call at 11:30 at night saying, "What are you doing?" You know, and off we go to P.J. Clark's or Patsy's or one of the places. But he was very smart about things. I mean, and particularly, obviously, about his music. He had listened carefully to different people. He listened to Tommy Dorsey and other, who was a beautiful, melodic, liquid trombone player and band leader. And he listened to the way he phrased music, when to sustain a note, etc. He listened to Billie Holiday and noted he didn't try to sing like her, but he did try to do what she did, which was to take music written by other people and turn it into autobiography. And by doing that, Sinatra, along with Joe DiMaggio and Fiorella LaGuardia, drove the stereotype of the Italian immigrant with the monkey and the organ grinder, drove it right off the stage, never to return. Suddenly, the Italians were urban. The Italians were not peasants from the back of Sicily or Calabria, or wherever. They were urban. And Sinatra was instrumental in that. And years later, I began to run into people who, Puerto Ricans, for example, some of my friends who are Puerto Rican, who learned how to speak carefully in English by listening to Sinatra, because the phrasing in the songs was so clear, was so exact. And they listened to that and repeated the words to get it right. So he had an effect on people other than the Italians, the Irish, and the Jews, but all the new arrivals who were coming into the city indirectly had an influence just by the way he did things. So that's why I called it Why Sinatra Matters. It was not the Gone with the Wind of Sinatra's love life or something, you know. It was about why the music mattered, why it was different. He came along and American popular music turned urban, because Crosby, as good as he was from area code 800. You know, we don't know where he's from. From Walla Walla, Washington, or wherever.
Yeah.
And he was very good, but that's why he and Sinatra together were very good.
What a swelligant, elegant party this is.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I learned some stuff in school when I was young, but I also learned a lot of important things from reading the back of album jackets. And I read and reread the back of Dylan's Blood on the Tracks LP many, many times. And on that album in 1974, you wrote about us surviving the plague. And,
yeah.
And you were on the front lines of that plague, weren't you?
Yeah, I was there. Yeah. You know, I didn't quite think of it that way in the present tense of the thing. But when I would step back and mull it for a while, I said, "Holy cry, I'm lucky I'm alive." It was quite an amazing period, wonderful time. I give you a good example of the kind of things that you learned. I was in London doing some work on something, some piece that I was doing. And I had cousins there from Ireland who lived in London. And they started raving about this group called the Beatles. So I sent a cable to, no internet in those days, I sent a cable to my editor at the Saturday Evening Post. I said, there's this British rock and roll group called the Beatles. Everybody's talking about it. Maybe I should do a piece. Back came a cable to me the next day. Beatles Schmeedles. Who cares about a British rock and roll band? And I kept it for years because I would run into them every once in a while. Hey, I got a cover. Hey, Bill, look at this. So since the music was, you know, I offer that only as an example of the kind of thing that was going on.
Yeah.
To have a ringside seat for a lot of it, which is what I had as a reporter, it was a huge privilege, although I didn't think of it that way. It seemed like that's the way the world was. And the world was going to be that way for a long time. And it wasn't. But it was a great, exhilarating time, as you can see a whole consciousness forming out of the wreckage of different things, out of Vietnam, out of the new generation, the children of the GI Bill, who made up the new middle class, etc. It was a great historical time.
We're talking with Pete Hamill. When did Robert Kennedy decide to run for president? Were you there when he was making those decisions?
No, I wasn't. I was in Ireland, but I had sent him a letter making all the arguments for it. I knew him a little from covering politics. And I don't have a copy of it. Richard Reeves had a copy of that letter. And I made the argument that you can't wait. You know, this is crucial to the country. Somebody's got to change this thing and do something about it, because by then I had gone to Vietnam. My brother John was in Vietnam during the Tet Offensive as a soldier. I had friends who went there and had their brains scrambled by the place. And that was 68. And 67, 68, and I was making the argument that you can't wait, and which helped persuade him. He knew that after John Kennedy was killed. Bobby learned from that you can't wait. You couldn't. Jack Kennedy talked about pulling out and getting out of Laos and getting out of Vietnam, where there were advisors posing as champions of democracy and stuff. So you had to do it when the opportunity was there. You couldn't wait till the next election. You couldn't wait 4 more years. You had to do it. And because who knows who's standing in the shadows with a rifle ready to kill you. So I think it gave him an urgency, him being Bobby Kennedy.
Yeah.
An urgency that Jack didn't have, even though Jack had been in the war and survived the war. But he thought he had 8 years coming, and he didn't. So that sense of the clock ticking, of the urgency of being an American, is still something I feel when I drift back into that period for whatever reason, either suggested by music or seeing some anniversary on television or whatever. Unfortunately, we didn't learn anything from it.
Yeah, I was going to say, in 1975, 1974, when Blood on the Tracks came out, and we thought about, oh, well, the plague is over, Nixon's gone, the war is over. But, you know, it seemed like another plague, you know, a worse plague.
Yeah.
And which is still maybe going on.
Yeah. And one reason, of course, was that after the war ended badly and we had lost the war, there were no major hearings in Washington where you try to sort it out and figure out what happened. What should we learn from this, etc. One reason being that Watergate came along and crowded it right out of the front pages of the papers and off television. And because Watergate and the hearings involving Watergate came and dominated, we never had the discussion about Vietnam. Now, obviously, we had many books on Vietnam. I was with, the other night, I was with Peter Arnett, who saw more combat than all the generals put together in Vietnam. He was 13 years in Vietnam. And he said that there's roughly 30,000 books about the Vietnam War, and nobody reads any of them, you know?
But there was never like a Warren Commission or whatever to...
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And after World War II, we had hearings, too, about were we forewarned about the Japanese impending planning an attack, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, they had some impact on the way the history was written. But Vietnam... No lessons, and one of the lessons should have been that nationalism is a much more strong, a more powerful force than any economic theory. They were not sitting in those spider holes in Vietnam, the Viet Cong, discussing Marx's theory of surplus value. They were talking about how do we get the foreigners the hell out of our country. And we didn't learn that, and off we go to Afghanistan a generation later, and like we're going to turn it into Minnesota, and we see the consequences there after a decade.
Yeah, that is, you know, you go to a place where you don't understand the culture.
Yeah.
And that we do it exactly the same thing every time.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And now with Chapo under arrest, mm-hmm. That makes Karzai the leading drug dealer in the in the world now, or his family. The poppies are blooming. I hate to sound cynical about it, but I just wish a little sustained skepticism was in part of our foreign policy. I really do.
Do you think... Somebody said to me... they were quote in the Wizard of Oz when they say the wizard says, she says, you're a bad man. He goes, no, I'm not a bad man. I'm just a bad wizard. Somebody was saying that about President Obama, that he's not a bad man, but just a bad president. What's your take on President Obama?
Disappointment, which I think is general among a certain number of people who did vote for him. I'm not sorry I voted for him or anything like that, but I expected more rigor. What's interesting is that even his eloquence has begun to drift away because he's reading some of the worst prose in the history of mankind every day. You read the health care bill, all 2,200 pages of it or whatever the hell it is. It's got to leave some part of your brain fractured. And that might be true of almost anybody who becomes president. And we can see it now, the impotence faced with dilemmas like Syria and now the Ukraine and Crimea, that there's limits to what we can do. We don't do war very well. We haven't won a war on our own since Spain in 1898.
Yeah, that was a good one, though.
Yeah, we got the Philippines and Puerto Rico, you know. But we, you know, we fought a draw in Korea. We lost Vietnam. Grenada wasn't a war. It was a raid.
Yeah.
And it might be that we'd be better off if there was a law that said before you put another American boot on the ground, the draft must return, that the sacrifice has to be shared by everybody, not just get poor young dopes who go and do 6-7 tours back and forth, and their marriages in distress, to say the least. And God knows what their dreams are like. And here we are, and nobody cares about them. You tried to get something through the Senate the other day to increase education benefits and medical benefits and all that, turned down by the great patriots of the United States. So I hope the veterans are seeing things clearly, too, because what we do with them is shameful, in my opinion.
Well, people, if you're feeling badly,
yeah,
pick up this book. It's called The Christmas Kid and Other Brooklyn Stories. It's a fabulous collection of stories, and the author, Pete Hamill. It's just been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me. Thank you very much.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. I want to thank my guest, Pete Hamill. His latest book is The Christmas Kid and Other Brooklyn Stories. This week, spend some time at our podcast page, fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Talk to you next time.